Hello, it's Alyssa Milano, and I can't wait for you to read my new book, Sorry Not Sorry. It's a collection of essays where I share my unapologetic thoughts on life, culture, activism, and motherhood. You'll learn some things about me that I know you've never heard before and share in my story as an activist. This book is such a big part of my heart, and so are you, and thank you for that. Sorry Not Sorry is available now, everywhere books are sold. Hi, I'm Alyssa Milano, and this is Sorry Not Sorry.
If it seems like the richest people in the world are getting richer at the expense of everyone else, it's because they are. A recent report from Oxfam illustrates just how much richer the wealthiest people in the world are getting. And to discuss what it means for the rest of us, I've invited Nabil Ahmed to the podcast. Nabil is the Director of Economic Justice for Oxfam America.
The intuition that inequality is divisive and socially corrosive has been around since before the French Revolution.
This is a government soup kitchen giving free meals to these men who were once skilled workers in a factory.
America has seen an economic collapse before. During the Great Depression, the nation was brought to its knees.
The pandemic has impacted people's financial situation very differently. For some, their wealth has grown over the last year and a half. For others, they have sunk further into poverty.
I have legally used the tax laws to my benefit and to the benefit of my company, my investors, and my employees.
Hi, I'm Nabil Ahmed, and I'm fighting to end today's crisis of wealth inequality. Sorry, not sorry.
Thank you so much for joining the podcast. I'm wondering if you could just start by telling us a bit about Oxfam and the incredible work it does here in America and around the world.
Yeah, sure. So firstly, thank you so much, Alyssa, for having me on and having Oxfam on. It really is such an honor. Oxfam is an international network of organizations that fights poverty, that fights inequality in 90 countries around the world. Ultimately, we believe that poverty is a political and policy choice, and we take on inequality to take on its root causes.
I couldn't agree more. And you are the Director of Economic Justice for Oxfam. Tell us a bit about that role, and just let my listeners know a little bit about what economic justice means and how we're going to go about achieving it.
Sure, Alyssa. Look, economic justice has a long and profound lineage that Oxfam is part of today. Economic justice is really about taking on the structures within our economy that deprive people of opportunity, that deprive people of hope. I said a long lineage. I see that lineage goes back through Martin Luther King Jr. to FDR to post-colonial leaders around the world who really believe that we can structure our economies very differently so that wealth, so that income is distributed in a far fairer way so that we can provide people good, dignified jobs, provide people the essential services that they depend on, and really build economies that invest in our children. And Oxfam works on economic justice. We work on economic justice here in the US and around the world. We work hard to ensure that workers' voices are heard. Those workers deep in the supply chains of big corporations who cut the chickens that we eat and buy at the supermarket, to those folks deep in supply chains around the world, we work to give them a voice. We push for their right. We push for fairer tax systems to ensure that we don't have a world in which billionaires pay a lower tax rate than daycare workers, than teachers. And we also push hard, Alyssa, to ensure that we really take on the climate crisis. Is there a bigger economic justice issue of our time to then restructuring our economy so we're not burning the planet around us and burning it really at the excess emissions of the richest in our world? This is what economic justice is about for me. And I say justice because it's not charity. It's justice. It's a deeper moral cause that we're a part of.
I think people don't really or can't really comprehend how everything intersects around this issue. You mentioned the environment. I got an alert on my phone this morning that said we're going to have a blizzard in California. And not in the mountains, like where blizzards would normally happen, you know, in the ski resorts, but, you know, where I live. And when you think about the impact of economic justice, the lack of economic justice, and say, like, the unhoused, and how that's the first thing that I thought of this morning when I got this alert was we have a huge unhoused issue in Los Angeles County and Ventura County. How are we going to get them off the street before Friday and Saturday? Everything is intersectional, and I think people don't connect those dots. Before we get into the survival of the richest report, can you just give my listeners a brief economic overview of just how people around the world are faring in general? If you want to just split it up between like before the pandemic and what we're seeing now, that would be great.
Yeah, sure, Alyssa. I'm so grateful to you for asking about folks around the world, because the issues faced by everyday Americans and the issues faced by people right around the world, they're so deeply connected. And also, the decisions that we also make here have a massive impact on billions of people right around the world. And look, as we'll be able to get through this interview today, we're going to see really how we are living through an extraordinary time of extreme inequality. That story did not start yesterday. That story didn't even start a couple of years ago at the start of the pandemic. But we have seen this rising crisis of extreme inequality for decades now.
The average American worker makes around $58,260 a year. The average American CEO will make about that much in less than 7 hours on the first workday of 2023. That is how bad inequality has gotten here in the United States, where CEO pay has really skyrocketed. In fact, it has increased 1,322% from 1978 to 2020.
We've seen inequality really rising over a 40-year period. It reminds us, by the way, it wasn't always this way. It's not inevitable. It comes down to the policy and the political choices that we make. We have seen inequality rising, Alyssa, but we've also seen some trends that show us some hope as well. We've seen poverty declining. Extreme poverty has been on the decline in the decades prior to the pandemic around the world. And that was a success story. But you know what? We started to get nervous in the 2000s. And then when the global financial crash hit, and then through the 2010s, we said, folks, inequality is corrosive. It's harming these efforts to reduce poverty. While poverty was coming down, the rate at which poverty was coming down was really slowing up. And then in certain parts of the world, this is pre-pandemic, we started to see the numbers of poverty rising in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, in Latin America, in some countries in Asia. We started to put the warning bells out. We started to say, look, folks, sure, we can celebrate some of these successes, but if we're not going to tackle extreme inequality, if we're not going to restructure our economies, we're going to be in trouble. And then what? The pandemic hits. And the pandemic hits hard, Alyssa. It hits people around the world in every country. We called it the inequality virus, because in every country, it hit the poorest hardest. It hit women and girls hard. It hit racial and ethnic groups hard. Look at how Black people were hit, for example, in this country. And we have to recognize that was not inevitable. The way we structured our economies made so many people vulnerable to the harshest impacts of that virus. And that's the health impact, and it's the economic impact as well. And then come the pandemic, and the pandemic hits really hard. And we're in a moment today, Alyssa, and I just looked at the numbers. Extreme wealth and extreme poverty are rising for the first time simultaneously in 25 years. That is new. That should not be happening, but that's exactly what is happening. And we should all be concerned about it.
I think it's really hard for people to even wrap their heads around also the repercussions of the pandemic for decades to come. Because we're 3 years out, I still have long COVID. I have access to healthcare. I have access to money to pay for whatever isn't covered by my health insurance. I have teaching hospitals that are right in my area that I could go to, like UCLA or Cedars, who are doing this research on long COVID. But I think that there's a part of this we haven't even started to understand, which is like, what impact is long COVID going to have on our poverty levels? And it's just criminal that anyone would be getting richer during this time. Nothing infuriates me more than that.
You're so right, Alyssa. And firstly, I'm very sorry to hear about your long COVID, and I hope that goes away. And I know so many people are suffering from that, and it really can be quite debilitating. But look, nobody should have what we can call a good pandemic, right? But the truth is, let's look at the data. So first, we already knew we were facing this extraordinary crisis of wealth inequality. So check this out. Over the last decade, the 1% captured more than half of all new wealth created in the world. Frightening, alarm bells ringing, surely it can't get any worse. And then guess what? Since 2020, Alyssa, our data shows, so this is just in the last few years, since the pandemic, the 1% haven't captured just half of all new wealth created in the world, they've captured two-thirds of all new wealth. Can you believe that? Two-thirds of all new wealth. And that actually means that the 1% have actually got twice as much money as the rest of humanity, the 99% of us put together. These numbers are mind-boggling because sometimes we tell ourselves this, the rich will always get richer, poor will always get poorer. And sometimes I accept these truths, but this is something else that's going on. This is really profound. We can't hit snooze.
I also feel like that's a phrase that I don't know that I believed still went on. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer, right? I feel like that's so outdated. It's so like passe. Of course, we're going to take care of each other. But no, you see these mega billionaires getting richer, these corporations getting richer, the pharmaceutical companies getting richer, the oil companies getting richer. And people who are living paycheck to paycheck or living on very little money or in a war-torn area, you know, what we're seeing in Ukraine, which is causing that war alone is causing such a food insecurity. What we're seeing is just like inflation and ridiculous costs for simple things like eggs.
The cost of eggs has been soaring across the country.
The dramatic rise comes as millions of Americans are struggling with the high costs of inflation. In California, egg costs surged to a whopping $7.37 last week. That's up more than $5 from the same time last year when a dozen eggs cost only $2.35.
And you realize that that's what that phrase means. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. It's not just about not having the opportunity to dig themselves out of poverty, but it's also about like those who live paycheck to paycheck and have to pay all this money to get a dozen eggs.
You know, sometimes we use this phrase, let's not leave anyone behind. And it's a nice phrase, don't get me wrong. But really what we need to stop doing is pushing so many people so far behind, because that's what our economy is doing and that's what our choices are making. And Alyssa, I really like the way you picked up on the rich get richer kind of idea, because I almost feel we need to reframe the idea of inequality altogether, because it's not just about rich and poor now. It's about a super rich elite right at the very top. And then it's about the 99.9% of us getting pushed further behind. And that's what the data shows. You literally have billionaires spending their money to go off to space while people back on Earth just want healthcare, right? Just want their kids to have a brighter future, you know?
There's that great meme a few years ago that the billionaires are sending people off to space and people on Earth just want healthcare. Let's talk about the Oxfam report, Survival of the Richest, which came out in January. And it states that while the world generates about $42 trillion in new wealth, since 2020, the richest 1% of all people took two-thirds of that wealth, as we have just been discussing. Why was it important to do this report? And why now?
There are many ways which we can pick up the papers and read about what's going on in our economy, Alyssa. For us, it's so important to track what's happening to the distribution of wealth and also the distribution of power in our society. And we put this report out every year to show people what's happening to wealth and power in our economy, because it impacts all our lives. We release it timed with the Davos World Economic Forum that takes place in the Swiss mountains every year, where the world's richest billionaires and corporation leaders and governments get together to high-five one another and celebrate their new riches. And we hold them to account. Alyssa, this is what we do. We hold them to account. We say, this is what's happening as a result of the choices that you make. These are some of the voices also that you need to listen to that are deep within your supply chains, so the people that exist within your country, and we try to amplify their voices. And Alyssa, the other thing we try to do is to show that another way is possible. Another way is really possible, that none of this is inevitable, that there are some countries that are showing that it can do the right thing. There's evidence that shows we can do the right thing. There's history that we can do the right thing.
What countries are showing that the right thing can be done?
Yeah, there's a range of examples here. So we can learn from, and let's cut through the issues here. So you mentioned healthcare before. You have a country far poorer than the United States. Look at Costa Rica and how Costa Rica implemented universal healthcare for its people. Its life expectancy not only beat the US, but other countries around the world. That's a country that shows universal healthcare isn't some kind of impossible thing that a country can't achieve. It can be done. You could look at countries like, let's take the issue of taxation. New Zealand, for example, has recently increased the taxes on the very richest in its society. Another example, Spain actually is going about increasing wealth taxes in its society. It's already been doing it for a number of years and it's keeping on that track. We have so many examples. But Alyssa, do you know what my favorite example is? It's the actual example of the United States. Not today's United States. The United States in the wake of World War II, at a moment, by the way, where we saw such extreme inequality, because we have been here before, took the kind of action necessary to create far more equal society. In the wake of World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, for example, took action against corporate monopolies, took action to back workers' rights. He went to Congress to push for a 100% top marginal income tax rate on the very richest in society. So the people who would earn above $1 million would be taxed 100%. He didn't get that. Okay. He got 94% after negotiating with them. And that top marginal income tax rate in the US between the end of World War II and 1981, it averaged 81%, an era which radically reduced inequality, in which this country put a man on the moon. I'm not saying we do 94% today, but I'm saying let's have the kind of ambitious discussion to rewrite the rules of our economy in the way that we know that we can.
It's political will, right? And not to harp on it, but I'm just going to put it again in perspective. So bear with me. There was another Oxfam report in 2022, which said that almost 1 billion people could be living in extreme poverty, in part because of the pandemic. 2/3 of the $42 trillion of the new wealth generated since 2020 is about $28.1 trillion, which went to the richest 1%. I just want everyone listening to think about what difference would that $28.1 trillion have made in the lives of those living in extreme poverty.
Oh, Alyssa, it's so true. There is so much wealth and so much resource, so much potential in the world. There is absolutely no justification for anybody on the planet to be living in extreme poverty or poverty.
Rich got richer, poor got poorer. What's a big deal here, you may wonder? The deal is the gap between the richest and the poorest widened during the pandemic. This is according to a new report by Oxfam.
I don't know how it's allowed to happen in normal conditions, but when there is a global health pandemic, when a crisis driving people into poverty, inflation making it more difficult to put food on the table, and that's happening globally, and we got one side in this country that's saying it's because of Biden, which is a load of bullshit. How did so much of the wealth get concentrated to so few people? And why is it allowed?
Yeah. And it's a question, and I think, Alyssa, you know the answer better than I, but it's to do with policies. It's about political will. It's about all these policies that have taken a real hammer at workers' rights, so taken a hammer at taxation of the richest, taking us in the US from a country which literally had, and this is, you can research this, folks, literally had the fairest, most progressive tax system in the world. And we've gone from that to a tax system which billionaires pay a lower tax rate than teachers. So a sledgehammer at taxes, a sledgehammer at workers' rights, allowing monopolies to basically menace our democracies. We've allowed all of this to happen because it didn't happen by accident. It happened because our government let it. But I also think there's a dangerous story that underpins all of this. There's a dangerous story that tells us that we need freedom, but that freedom really is just for the richest in society. It's freedom for corporations. It's freedom to make as much profit as you wish. It's freedom for the bullies in our economy, but it's not individual freedom that provides security to people. It's not the freedom from fear of going hungry or the freedom from fear of being sick and then not being able to go to work the next day. I think we need to reclaim this story.
I just want to, I'm going to say this real simple for my listeners, because I think often we talk about these broad strokes, right? And these numbers that, like, it's real hard to quantify them, but also it's hard to make it personal. If you're one of my listeners and you're not a billionaire, you're paying more in taxes, no matter what you do, than the billionaires. I don't care if you're a doctor. I don't care if you're whatever it is, whatever, a teacher, a fireman, you are paying more in taxes than the billionaires. Hopefully that makes it a little bit more personal for you and you're able to really identify where the problem lies and also make conscious decisions on how to fix it. Because let me tell you, a government for the people in the United States becomes a government for the people throughout the world. And we have the power to lift people out of poverty. We just do not have the political will. Recently, Elon Musk lost about $200 billion. With this loss, he went from being the world's richest person to the world's second richest person. What does it say about us that we have such extremely wealthy individuals when there's so much poverty and so much critical cultural work that is starved of funding?
We can run through the policies, but I think above all, it speaks to a profound moral sickness that we can allow for a society in which we have such extremes. And I think, you know, for those folks of us who are working for economic justice, what are we calling for? We're calling for people's economic right to be met, like you've said, for health, quality education, for quality jobs for people so they can live lives of real dignity. Really, it's not that radical. The radical ones are the ones who think that we should live in a world at such extremes. And you know what? The rich will remain rich. That's okay, you know? When I see and I think of people in my extended family, I think of small business owners, and they look after their employees. They're kind to their communities. They want to earn money. That's great. What a great thing to do. I think we have a problem here when we have a super elite that relies too often on exploitation, on rigging the rules in their favor, because that does all of us an injustice. And you mentioned as well, just bringing it home, the tax rate issue of billionaires. And we can say it, Alyssa, and your politics, you know, have been so powerful over the years, and they won't expect maybe you and me to say it, but Warren Buffett, one of the richest people in the world, still has said that he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary.
Right now, Warren Buffett pays a lower tax rate than his secretary.
Just hours after her moment in the spotlight, Debbie Bosanek was back at her day job.
When she goes away for a couple of days, you know, nothing happens. So,
what happened yesterday?
Just wait for her to come back.
Bosanek has been famed investor Warren Buffett's secretary for 19 years, but now she's gaining stardom of her own as the face of tax inequality.
We've got folks like Bill Gates out there who is actually himself pushing for the rich to be taxed more. You've got the group of patriotic millionaires, an amazing group, by the way, super rich folks led by people like Abigail Disney. They're saying we're the rich and tax us more. Amidst all this despair, Alyssa, I do look back over this decade and I think we've just lost so much opportunity. We've lost a decade to lip service, really. But there is a little bit of hope. And that hope is coming from the change that we push for, Alyssa, the change that I know many of your listeners push for. We've got some way to go, but boy, is a fight on.
I want to go back a little bit in time. You mentioned before 40 years ago that things shifted. And in the 1980s, we heard a lot about trickle-down economics. And it seems to me that really this report puts that myth to rest forever. Is there anything at all trickling down from the wealthiest people?
No. So the idea of trickle-down economics is deeply interconnected to the economic ideology of our time, this neoliberal economic ideology, which tells us, let's strip back the rules, let's strip back the taxes, let's strip back the rights of workers, let's allow for greater monopoly power, let's privatize public goods. And yes, let's have, you know, wealthy people in our society, and the idea being that we can let their wealth trickle down to the rest of us. I think that's been proven to have failed. Our numbers show that. The numbers of many others have shown that. There was some great research over a 40-year period over multiple countries that showed that this wealth actually hasn't trickled down, that you can't correlate. But there's a sinister piece to this thinking as well, because it tells us that instead of allowing government, instead of allowing our democracy to work to build fairness in society, it tells us, no, actually rely on the very richest in society and let their wealth and let their power pull you ahead. That sounds a little bit like oligarchy to me. That sounds, and I was just reading over Jimmy Carter, by the way, in these days, Alyssa, and what he said about oligarchy. It's so powerful. But I think there's a dangerous piece here, because relying on those folks right at the top to have a fairer society for us to be able to invest in our children is not going to work. We need more democracy, not less. I'm always taken aback, Alyssa, by this amazing quote by a former US Supreme Court justice about a century ago, Louis Brandeis. And he said, we can either have extreme concentration of wealth or we can have democracy, but we can't have both.
Let's talk solutions, because otherwise it's just too daunting. We have to figure out what the solutions are. How do we turn it back so that most of the world's wealth is with most of the world's people? Here in the United States, I have very little faith, right? Because you have one political party screaming socialism when there's any kind of program designed to benefit the vast majority of people. And then the other party that's so precious in the way in which we get things done that it seems like we can't even agree on how to do it. So what are your thoughts? What are the solutions? How do we figure this out?
The starting point is this. Extreme inequality, extreme wealth concentration, it's not inevitable. We do have the policy and the political levers to make a change, and it's really genuinely in our hands. And we can do a bunch of things here. We can address monopoly power. There's no reason we should have these mega corporations which dominate markets, which rig the rules in their favor. We can boost workers' rights. By the way, we're seeing some action at a state level that's quite inspiring. We can boost workers' rights. We can ensure workers are paid a living wage. We can really push for ambitious solutions here. We can invest in the proven powerful equalizers that we know allow for a far more equal society and just for us to live without fear. And you mentioned the main one, universal healthcare. It's also universal education. It's also issues like social protection. But underlying all of these is the importance of taxing the very wealthiest. And it can sometimes sound like a slogan, but let me tell you, it's not. Because one of the most powerful policy solutions through history and to this very day to allow for a more equal society in which people's rights are met is taxing the very wealthiest. It's a strategic precondition to a more equal society. And what does that mean? It can mean a bunch of things, but if I was to break it down into three things that we could do, number one, we can push for one-off taxes on the very wealthiest and on corporations. Number two, we can push for the very, very richest in society. So this isn't the teachers. This isn't the daycare workers like my family members. This isn't the middle class. Taxing the very, very people at the top of society to ensure that they are paying a higher rate of their income towards taxes and ensuring that their capital gains, which is how they make most of their money, is at the same level taxed as income.
Remember the way that the wealth tax is built. It says if your fortune is below $50 million, nothing. We're not talking to you. If it's above $50 million, your 50 millionth and first dollar, you got to pitch in 2 cents. 2 cents for every dollar above that. You hit $1 billion in assets. You got to pitch in a few pennies more.
So that's number two. Number three, the most powerful solution that we have on taxation to address extreme wealth concentration, Alyssa, is wealth taxes. Wealth taxes really is how we get strategic. And just to give you one example, by way of illustration, right? A wealth tax of up to 5% on the world's multimillionaires and billionaires, that would generate about $1.7 trillion a year. That's enough to lift 2 billion people out of poverty and to guarantee universal healthcare for all the people living in poorer countries around the world.
How do we do it? How do we get moving on this? How do we get the government to move?
This is probably the most important question, isn't it, Alyssa? Because we can talk policies, we can put forward the data. For me, I think I look at successful movements through history, and we are part of a movement, Alyssa, and we're standing alongside you and standing alongside many others in this movement for more equality. It's movements that make a change. It's educating one another, building this idea that the power of the people is greater than the people in power. That's what we're about. I think it's about coming together, educating one another, having those conversations with our uncles and aunts over the dinner table, knocking on the doors of our neighbors. I think sometimes we glamorize some of political action, but if we haven't convinced our neighbors, then we haven't really started. So it's about change at that level. It's about getting the message out there. It's showing that this is the mainstream, that we are a powerful mainstream that believes a fairer economy is possible. And if you look at great movements through history, that's how they won change.
I feel like we don't have the attention span to have a sustainable movement. I feel like in the past, when movements have created such powerful change, it was sustained movement. I feel like there are so many issues and there are so many different organizations that are fighting very specific things. And this is part of the reason why I love Oxfam so much, is because I feel like you understand the intersectionality, right? You understand that everything has to work together in order to fix things. And so I feel like everyone is spread so thin and everyone has their own causes that they fight for. And it's not what we see in these countries where we see a sustained movement, people using their voices day after day until there is change.
We live in an age of protest. On campuses, in public squares, on streets and social media, protesters around the world are challenging the status quo. Protests can thrust issues onto the national or global agenda. It can force out tyrants. It can activate people who have long been on the sidelines of civic life. But while protest is often necessary, is it sufficient? Consider the Arab Spring. All across the Middle East, citizen protesters were able to topple dictators.
For us, I feel like it's kind of like, okay, I'll meet you downtown at 3 and then we can go have cocktails at 7. We'll protest for a couple of hours and then we'll go for happy hour and go have some French fries. And it's frustrating, but it's also, you know, I think a direct product of the fact that we're of a generation that is used to immediate gratification, that can look at the phone and just swipe if they don't like something. Our attention span is just so small. You know, for my listeners who are change makers, whether it be on a bigger scale or within your own family or community, make sure that you have the energy for sustainability. You have to sustain this work. You don't get to show up to one protest and expect everything to be better. You have to use your voice. You have to educate people on who to vote for. You have to support organizations like Oxfam, which, Nabil, tell people how people can support Oxfam's work.
Yeah, sure. Firstly, Alyssa, for what it's worth, endorse everything that you said, because I'm reminded, by the way, that distraction and diversion is actually a political tool that's used to prevent us from succeeding in our movements. And for us, we're almost distracted. I think of the good guys, I think many of the good guys, right? And we're distracted by good things, look at this thing on Twitter or that thing on Instagram, and that's great. I also think that I look at the way that especially like racism is used to divide people. Like people say, and it's true, that racism disproportionately impacts Black communities, and we know the impact of that. But there's another way of understanding this issue as well, which is to say that racism is also weaponized to divide communities, to say to people that those folks are less deserving. I experienced, for example, when we worked on the vaccine issue, and thanks for covering that, by the way, in this podcast, they said, don't push for a people's vaccines because those countries with Black and brown folks, they can't make good vaccines. Only as big monopolies in the rich countries that we, that was a form of racism too. So
maybe the most unfortunate form of racism, because the fact that pharmaceutical companies are still making money off of vaccinations during a pandemic, and by the way, not helping those who are still suffering with long COVID. I mean, it's all a mess.
$1,000 of profit a second, by the way, the three big pharma companies. And guess who paid for that vaccine to develop it? It was us. It's appalling, really.
Okay, tell people who are also appalled how to support Oxfam's work.
Thank you for asking that question, Alyssa. So Oxfam does a whole range of work to take on inequality. We have our numbers out there. We have our data out there. Please pick it up. Go to our Twitter and our Instagram. We're on Oxfam America is our handle. We're on oxfamamerica.org. Share this literature around in your communities, in your networks. That's one part. One of the reasons I love Oxfam, Alyssa, is that we're brave. We're a brave organization. We take on power. We take on those folks who are holding back social justice, be they on the Hill in politics, be they elsewhere. We take on corporations. If you go into OxfamAmerica.org, you can sign up to be part of our list. And Oxfam is also in over 90 countries around the world. Right now, for example, I was just hearing from my colleagues working in Syria, working in Turkey, helping those who've been hit hard by the earthquake over there. That's another way you can join and support Oxfam. We're trying to take on the root causes of inequality, but we're also taking on the symptoms of inequality and when the system falls apart. And the system is just falling apart time and time again, Alyssa, right across the world.
Finally, what gives you hope?
You know, honestly, I do find hope in speaking with people like you, Alyssa, understanding the voices of your listeners, fundamentally knowing that we are not alone, that there's so many people. We find ways to come together, and this is one of the ways that we can come together. And I do find genuine hope in that. And I also want to say that, you know, sometimes pushing for greater equality, pushing for social justice, it's a hard slog. Sometimes you wake up in the morning, you think, did I do anything yesterday? Did I really make a difference in the world? But, you know, zoom out a bit, and I look over this last 10 to 15 year period, and the way that the world is talking about inequality today, that could not be heard 15 years ago. The way that we are talking about taxing billionaires today, even look at President Biden's State of the Union address, that would have been laughed at a decade ago. We have a global corporate tax deal. It's way further than what we needed. But you know what? I was literally remember the moment 10 years ago, and so we were told, that's idealistic. That'll never happen. And the sum effect of us coming together, of getting through those difficult mornings, of keeping at it, I honestly believe it's having an impact. The kind of debates we're having now, the kind of progressive solutions that we're pushing for, it's happening. Let's keep at it. This is a story of change. Like you said, it's not going to happen overnight. It comes through sustained pressure. It comes through building power together, and I believe we'll get there.
Well, Nabil, you give me hope. Thank you for all you do and for being a part of the podcast.
Thank you so much, Alyssa.
How have we gotten to a point where we can have high corporate profits when businesses can be doing so well,
right. But
the workers don't necessarily share in that prosperity?
Well, this has been at least a three-decade-long trend. Now, there are a whole bunch of reasons for that. Some of it has to do with technology and entire sectors being eliminated, travel agents, bank tellers, a lot of middle management. A lot of it has to do with globalization. The rest of the world's catching up. Post-World War II, we had just some enormous structural advantages because our competitors had been devastated by war. And we had also made investments that put us ahead of the curve, whether in education or infrastructure. Those advantages went away at the same time as workers increasingly had less leverage because of changes in labor laws. You combine all that stuff and it's put workers in a tougher position. So some people who just control enormous amounts of wealth, you know, we don't resent their success. On the other end, just as a practical matter, you know, you're going to have problems making sure that we're investing enough in the common good to be able to move forward.
Nobody in the world should be able to lose $200 billion and still be one of the richest people in the world. In fact, nobody in the world should have $200 billion in the first place. Not when people are starving or even struggling in the world. People could still be ridiculously wealthy, right? I mean, wealthy enough to support generations of wealth in their families and come nowhere near being a billionaire. And here's the thing, literally none of these billionaires are self-made. None of them. Each of them, every single one, either inherited great wealth or generated great wealth through the labors of others along with their own. And most often, it's both. There is plenty of pie to go around, but not if 1% of the people hold all but a single slice of the pie. I know the people on the right are screaming socialism and redistribution of wealth. But here's the thing. You can't redistribute something which has never been distributed in the first place. The richest people are hoarding the promise and hope of the world, and our governments need to step in and stop it. So many of the world's problems depend on their actions.
Sorry Not Sorry is executive produced by Alyssa Milano. That's me. Our producer is Ben Jackson, audio editing and engineering by Maciej Lewandowski, and music by Josh Cook, Alicia Eagle, and Milo Bugliari. Don't forget to rate, review, and spread the word. Sorry, not sorry.